Jeffrey Milsom could not make it to us today. I can't tell you exactly why, but it's a good reason. And so to replace him.
Yeah, Sam Sharma is a surgeon, general surgeon at Cornell University. He's been, he actually came to Cornell as a Fulbright scholar from UK. And he's been actually working in developing new technologies and tools for endoluminal surgery. So he's going to talk to us a little bit about what he's been working on and what's new out there that can help us do these complex polyp treatments using endoluminal technology.
So while Sam loads up, let me just, come on up, guys, for the last one, because we don't want to waste time. So, Sang, do you close a defect? Most of the time, if you're doing it endoscopically, you take off a polyp piecemeal.
I don't.
All right, good. I do probably more often than not, because I got a double channel scope that I think it makes it easier. Frozen section?
No.
No. Larry, you were doing frozen sections for a while, and I think, you know, the question comes is it practical? And who do you do it on?
We're submitting an abstract about that. I mean, the problem is our pathologists are unwilling to make a final call. So you get in, you're standing with them, and you go, come on.
Surprising.
What do you think? And they go, you know, so the thing is we've had in 115 patients, we've had five that we've removed successfully. We're told the frozens were either maybe some dysplasia or benign, and then they come back 4 days later, and they go, no, it's a cancer. So I think the frozens are kind of useless. However, medical legally, there's an issue of whether it's reasonable to do that, and so I think we'll continue to try to do that. I'm trying to get the pathologist to be more bold, but you know, you've been in that situation where they go, we'll have to wait for the permits.
Yeah. So I just haven't done it, but I informed the patient that we may need to come back and do a formal colectomy later, and they are really understanding because they're just so happy you're going to manage this thing that they've usually seen one or two people before you by the time you come to you, and when you tell them you're going to just take care of it, they understand what's going to happen.
Can I say something? Maybe a few times I used it, and these times were, I'm in the operating room, and I look at the lesion. This is really looking like cancer, like naked eye, and several times I send it just to confirm, and then the pathology comes back firmly, yes, cancer, and then you do the bowel resection. These are probably the only indications that is useful.
Okay, question over here. We can take it. So, yeah, what are things that say that this is worrisome? Sang and Emery, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I look at the morphology. I mean, I think if there's ulceration, pit patterns, I mean, it's out there, but it's not very practical for us. But looking at visually, looking at morphology, I think is probably the most important. High-grade dysplasia, certainly worrisome. I think you're a little bit of, alarm, but if you really do, as a final check, if you scope the patient before you do anything, and if you really do think it's benign, chances are they are benign. So that's certainly not a contraindication to doing something.
Let me just jump in there. I mean, the thing is, we looked at a series of 375 benign polyps that went to colectomy when I was at Columbia, and of those, there were 90 that had dysplasia, high-grade dysplasia. One-third of those patients had cancers. There's another series from England that looks at 100 patients with high-grade dysplasia, and about 40% there. So there is a kind of, the literature is split on this thing. I think, though, what Emra showed us is that we need to learn how to evaluate these things. We're just looking at them, get the report, look at the slides, say, yes, it's dysplastic. We don't try to further diagnose them on their appearance, and that is the answer to this, and that's why the people that are very good at this in Japan, they only, by the time they get there, they have a polyp staging board. Like we have tumor staging boards, they have those, and they look at 300 pictures, and then they decide what the heck it is with a group of people. We're not at that stage, but I think by the surface pattern, you can figure this out if you get good at it. But I am afraid of the dysplastic polyps, and I tell, just like Peter, though, I tell him, we can try this, and it's worth doing, but you understand you might need to come back.
And I tell you, the key to doing it, I think, is if it won't lift, if I inject and I know I'm in the right plane and it doesn't raise up, that's when I stop. And I think more times than not, I've been right in those scenarios.
And, we looked at this as well. And then, the most predictive feature in pre-operative or pre-resection examination was the presence of high-grade dysplasia. Size really is doesn't matter. You know, if it's really very large lesion, doesn't necessarily indicate malignancy. The reason we do, though, like why you biopsy and not, and there was a question about that. You know, I try to assess preoperatively, pre-resection with colored images, but sometimes there's certain angle, you know, there are limitations with that. So that's why when we are in the operating room, you may get a different angle, different look, and, you know, the morphology and pit pattern may look different to you, and if you are really certain that is high risk for cancer, definitely indicative of cancer, for example, that those are few cases that you can send frozen.
Larry, last comment, because we've got to move on.
Just about the fact that if they don't lift, you worry about invasion into the muscularis propria, but the mass majority of them is just being somebody had a snare on it beforehand, and so that's a dilemma. We've looked at that. All the ones we've sent as per our protocol to resection for that, almost 90% of them were benign in the end, but they had a snare application beforehand. So that's something to be worried.
But it's a de novo polyp and it won't lift. That to me, that's the bad sign.
Yeah, de novo. Absolutely, you have to be. We're always wary, but the point is, you want nobody to put a snare on it if
all right,
possible.
Sam's dying up here.
Beware. Also, scarred lesions don't lift.
Right.
Yeah, we need to, I think, make it.
That's what I'm saying.
All right. Sam, tell us what we need in our toolbox.
Okay. Let's do it. So thank you very much, Dr. Marcello, Dr. Lee, ladies and gentlemen. So, yes, can you hear me now? I'm going to come from this particular topic from a Cornell perspective, and here are my disclosures. So why are we here? At a macro level, at a high altitude level, the number of cases of cancer is projected to be almost 2 million in just a year from now. But colorectal cancer is actually increasing dramatically, not just in developing countries, but also in young persons. So those less than age 50, you've probably seen this in your practice, they're coming in more and more frequently, and we really don't know why. The precursor of that polyps, as has been mentioned by the previous speakers, is actually increasing. The surgery, the colectomy rates for benign polyps are increasing significantly, and over 26,000 colectomies are performed every year in the United States for benign disease. And the authors quite rightly make the conclusion in this paper that that sort of treatment strategy is really unacceptable in this current day and age. That coupled with the increasing costs of healthcare in the United States compared to our closest partners makes you sort of scratch your head and think, you know, what is really going on? What does the future hold? Are we currently at an untenable position? But we have some indicators from relatively recent history. Cardiac surgery had a dramatic change in the 80s from where they were doing quite morbid procedures to a percutaneous, minimally invasive approach. And we're starting to see the signs of that happening in our specialty right now. So that traditional paradigm of cutting out a piece, the cancerous piece, joining the two ends back together, is now making way to the endoluminal approach. So what do you need in your toolbox? You've seen all these great talks. You want to get started. I'm going to talk about what you need from a more basic point of view, going to the more advanced point of view. The first thing you need is you need a team of individuals that are going to be on board. So there's yourself. You need one or two people, a nurse or a tech, that want to go on this journey with you and will help and support you. And with that, you need training. And this was touched on before with Dr. Whalen and so forth, that just getting these tools and starting to use them is probably not the best strategy. You need to practice, whether that be in a lab, so that's our lab in New York, or in any room in the hospital, or even your basement at home. You need to practice consistently, either with standard simulation models, which you can buy and are pretty straightforward, ex vivo tissue to silicone models, or you can get a bit more sophisticated, which is what we do. We use custom 3D printed models, which model the abdominopelvic cavity, into which we then mount fresh tissue. So we're able to simulate intestinal dynamics. And we've taken an expert, an intermediate, and a novice in endoscopy, put them through training programs and showed dramatic improvements in both procedural time and also rate of dissection. And in our institution, people are now doing this more and more consistently. So I'm going to split the toolbox into the top half, which is the basic things that you need, and then getting into the more elaborate tools in the lower half. As mentioned before, I think the minimum thing that you're going to need as far as scopes are two different sizes. The first being the gastroscope for the left-sided lesions, and then the pediatric scope for the right-sided lesions. And then with regards to electrosurgery and Erbi or similar. And the main thing you want for those are the endocut and blend coag modes. We've talked about needle injectors. The one thing to consider here is that if you are thinking of using the more viscous submucosal injection agents, you may want to consider having a 22-gauge needle, a larger bore. It will make things a lot easier. Now, caps, you've seen them in the videos so far, but they really are an essential part of this. They separate the mucosal surface or the submucosal plane from the endoscope tip, and you can also perform point mucosal manipulation using it, and I'll show you some videos later. As far as submucosal injection agents, well, this is a very contentious topic at the moment. A recent meta-analysis showed that the best agents to use are Hespan and normal saline with methylene blue. However, there are better agents coming out, but we'll see what the results show. Moving forward, snares. So there's lots of snares on the market. We prefer the Lariat snare by US Endoscopy. The reason why, you can see there at the top right-hand corner, you have multiple different snare sizes in one snare, and it also comes with a needle injector incorporated into it, so you don't need to exchange instruments. So that's something to consider. Also, Olympus polyloops, which I'll show you a video on, are really important to have on your shelf, as well as clips, and you've seen what clips can do. So here you have a large pedunculated polyp in the sigmoid colon. The endoloop is passed at the base, and you can see that the polyp starts to blanch. At that point, you can then use your standard snare to remove the polyp. And once you've done that and removed the polyp, you can then inspect the stalk base. And that's really important because there's obviously feeder vessels in there that you don't want to bleed at 2 in the morning. So there you can see the polyloop placed there. We've talked about coag graspers before in the irrigation unit. Again, this is a key point. I've traveled the world extensively in the past couple of years, and it's amazing how many units
that's not real bleeding.
doesn't have coag graspers.
My heart's going up crazy just looking.
But even looking at it, so spraying some water at it and then grabbing it with a blunt forceps, which is what the coag grasper is, you're able to actually control pretty catastrophic bleeding, and it always looks worse. It looks worse than it is with the magnification of scopes. So again, irrigation and coag graspers. So now we're getting to the more fun stuff. So ESD knives. So we talked about a little bit about that previously, but you have two different types. One is your standard monopolar instrument, and the second type is the standard monopolar instrument with an injection capability. So your dual knife has been out for a very long time. It's been used throughout the world. But recently in the United States, you can now get the dual knife J, which has integral flushing capability. Again, this stops the need to exchange instruments, which takes a very long time. You have the nano. So on the bottom right there, you can see a ball on the end of it. That's a ceramic tip. So if you're particularly worried, let's say on the right-hand side, that you have the risk of perforation, then you may want to use such an instrument to reduce the electrical transfer of energy to deeper structures. And we at Cornell are actually starting to use snares. So with a bit of practice, just exposing the tip of the snare, you can actually get the same result. And I'll show you that a bit later. And obviously, you need specimen nets. We've talked about the retraction devices. Dr. Gorgon was talking about that. So clip and suture, using two scopes. Dr. Marcello spoke about that, double channel scopes. And you can also use two scopes. So your standard scope, which you perform your resection, you can actually use a slimmer gastroscope alongside it to actually provide retraction as well. And there are dedicated devices for retraction, such as the ORISE. Now, obviously, something that I'm closely involved with, the platforms. We call them platforms because you can perform different actions with the same device, a double balloon system. But coupled with it, you always have to consider the use of an insufflation unit, whether your standard CO2 endo unit or a laparoscopic insufflator. And we've been using laparoscopic insufflators in the OR now instead of the endo unit. So the Dilumen is a double balloon device. It fits on any standard colonoscope or gastroscope. It has two balloons, an aft balloon, which is fixed in position, gives you stability, and also a fore balloon, which you can extend out in front of the endoscope tip and acts as a retractor. So what you can do here is, this is a case of a giant ESD, so giant being larger than 4 centimeters. So once you've done the circumferential cut around the polyp, you can see there at the top, sutures are already placed on the fore balloon, and you can clip the mucosal edge to the fore balloon, and that provides your retraction. And here you can clearly see the muscular layer on the left. You can see the plane to dissect, And then you can also see the blood vessels clearly, and that is obviously of great use when performing these dissections, particularly in the rectum. Again, a very clear view when you're performing your dissection. Again, not just with ESD, but also with EMR, we found particular use for this platform in ileocecal valve polyps. So the difficulty with performing ESD or EMR on the right-hand side without such a device is that you'll get sigmoid looping, which causes a lack of one-to-one motion in the cecum. And that's difficult because you want to control. You need to know exactly what you're doing. And by using an overtube or a dilumen, you can essentially splint the sigmoid, and you can use the balloons to stabilize the endoscope tip. And that gets very useful in this situation. So here we're looking in retroflexion at a polyp that's at the ileocecal valve. Mm-hmm. And you can see the stability here and the one-to-one movement that you can get because we have the balloons inflated and the balloons inflated in the ascending colon and the sigmoid splinted. We tend to do hybrid procedures at Cornell. So we do a circumferential cut, and then in the confines of the circumferential cut, we'll perform an EMR. So we've done the proximal border. We now come to the distal side and then continue to perform that dissection. In this situation, we've then extended out the fore balloon to give a little bit of a buttress or a cushion, mm-hmm. so we can support our dissection as we progress. And we've been able to get very good results using this technique in the ileocecal valve. So what about next? So we've talked a bit about imaging in the sense that you can get more advanced equipment. So there's pretty interesting higher magnification scopes that you can get now, and also 3D, if you so choose. But when we think about imaging, we're increasingly using interventional radiology to assist us in our cases, and as well as cone beam CT. So this is a video of our new endo suites over at Cornell. So here, cone beam CT machine. You'll see as the camera pans across, there's an endoscopy tower in the background. And this is where we're increasingly performing a lot of our procedures. So what can you do? Well, with radiology, you can do interesting things. Again, for benign conditions, which would otherwise require a colectomy, a patient with recurrent volvulus, high anesthesia risk. And so what we're doing is placing the scope, delineating the borders of the intestine, and performing an anterior fixation. Again, all percutaneously, preventing the patient needing surgery, and with the guidance of radiology.
Pretty cool.
So now we're getting to where the limits are now with technology. So the C2 device is an extension of the dilumen. We created it really to transfer laparoscopic surgical principles, which we all know and love, into the endoluminal space. And from taking it from an idea, we've very recently done our first clinical case. So here we look ex vivo. So this is just in the lab. You can see there are two flexible articulating tools. On the left, you can see a flexible articulating grasper. So these are 95 centimeters long and can reach anywhere in the intestine. And then on the right, you can see the grasper. So what we're able to do here is control the scissor, control the grasper, and able to perform true surgical actions within the lumen of the intestine. The diameter of this whole unit is 2.2 centimeters. So you're seeing increased magnification. And what you can do with it is you can cold cut, as I'm doing there, but you can also use electrocautery to do hot cutting, or you can use it as a knife. And so moving from that ex vivo work to, let's say, within a pig, this is an excision of doing a live pig demo. You can see how we can get very tight concentric circles of mucosectomies with increased control. And this is sort of what we need as surgeons, that precision moving forward. So I'm going to show you a very short video of our first clinical case. This is a patient that had a lesion 10 centimeters up from the anal verge, 3-centimeter lesion. Here we're able to grasp. You can see it cutting. And we're also able to manage vessels with electrosurgery. So we're very excited to expand this case series moving forward. Also to consider is that now on the market are more fancy ways of doing the same thing. So you have the Med Robotics system, as well as the Da Vinci SP. So it'd be interesting to see what doctors end up doing with this moving forward. So I'll just leave you with, initially I first said that the team involves a couple of key individuals, but actually after seeing all those videos, I hope you appreciate that you want to start thinking about getting gastroenterologists involved, interventional radiologists involved to become part of your team. Because to be honest, the days of the separate surgeon or endoscopist or interventional endoscopist are coming to an end pretty rapidly. We're now approaching the era of the true endoluminal surgeon. So this technology, we hope, will really tackle the rising health burden that we've seen in our communities. We want to get to a stage where we are not doing colectomies for benign disease, and we are in the process, and I hope that you'll appreciate and come on board, that we are creating a brand new specialty to treat these diseases. Thank you.